Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And Colleen's back, sitting on the couch. Don't know if we'll hear from her or not this episode, but yeah. But regardless, we are back with a double feature of documentaries this week, when we look at the Maisel Brothers films, co-directed by a few other people in there, like Charlotte Zerwin and things, Salesman and Grey Gardens, from 1968 and 1975, respectively. So, I think, as we've done in the past with the double features and things, we're going to look at Salesman first, and then move on and, you know, spend our time with Grey Gardens.
Alright, Salesman first.
Yes.
A film following a series of four Bible salesmen. And, you know, the lifestyles they're in, or the kind of troubles, the serious troubles, the many troubles that a Bible salesman confronts from day to day, selling overpriced Bibles, $50 Bibles.
In 1967, it was being shot, so, yeah.
And apparently, these Bibles, if you were to buy them today, $50, then would be approximately $450 now.
Wow, I would not spend that much on a book ever.
Well, that's the thing, like, that's why...
It's so conflicting for these people, yeah. It is a super interesting documentary, I think. It is not exactly fun or enjoyable to watch.
Yes, it's definitely neither of those things.
Yeah. I think that's mainly because it's not a fun story. So, as such, we're kind of... You get really bummed out watching it. Well, I did for sure.
Yeah, I had a terrible time watching this movie.
I think it's based on, like, the... You know, it's just... The shilling, and it's like these guys know, you know, they specifically talk about how they're targeting low-income families and all this. It's not good.
It's abrasive on almost every level, because the filmmakers are producing a documentary where you're observing, and so...
Yeah, the subject that they've chosen to observe is... It's really interesting that it is, like, the dying breath of a former industry, like the door-to-door salesman. That used to be a thing. And now in the late 60s, it is dying, and we're getting kind of the glimpse of what is happening to the men of that industry and how they're kind of crumbling and falling apart. Super interesting. But at the same time, fuck those guys.
Yeah, they have this crazy this crazy attitude towards selling out their common man.
Yeah.
So there's all these angles of abrasiveness. There is the personalities that you're watching. There is the poor people that are trying to... They're trying to turn away these salesmen, but they don't have the balls or the courage to do it.
Yeah.
Then there is the filmmaking itself, the techniques used, that kind of allow the moments to drag on and become awkward and become disappointing.
Which I think is, it's 100% on purpose. Like, it is it's masterful filmmaking, I think, but it's just not... It's like watching a Lars von Trier film. It's like watching Antichrist or something. Or Salo. It's something that's just... It's upsetting to watch. But at the same time, you can really appreciate the craft behind making it, I guess.
I guess I can. But only to a certain point. I mean, I enjoy dry documentaries from time to time.
Yep.
Things like... I mean, I think Coco's in the collection... Too.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that's quite
is.
That's quite dry and abrasive.
Yes,
but I think for me, Salesman wasn't. There's like this. This is what I think. There's this kind of white teeter kind of situation going on. Is the film abrasive but fascinating enough for me to travel through the voyage?
Yeah, and then sustain through the 90 minutes.
Yeah.
With these guys.
And I'm not sure that Salesman was that.
No.
For me. Because we are just talking about... angry people...
Yeah.
Taking advantage of sad people.
Yeah, pretty much.
So...
Yeah, it's like... But...
There's two ways to go about the film. There's attacking the subject matter... And there's attacking the film making itself.
Yeah. I think... because there is very little to the actual narrative focus of this documentary. There isn't necessarily a point or a message to be gained from it, I feel, that's really strong. So I think it is one where we're going to have to kind of move the discussion more onto the filmmaking and the why it exists and the how it exists.
Yeah,
versus,
I would like
versus
to.
Because I feel if we get caught up on talking about like specific moments and the subjects of the documentary, we're going to get fucking angry.
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. So. That being said, like there was one. This would be like this was the one point in the film where I like made a mental note like I want to bring this up because it just kind of summarizes why I don't want to talk about the guys themselves. And it was when they arrive in Florida and Paul is having the huge discussion about like how all the streets and everything are named after like Arabian Nights, and they get off on this kind of like fuck that all that old Muslim shit, like they actually flat out say Muslim shit. It is, like, all fairy tales, and I just was like, guys, you're selling the Bible. Like, I just... The hypocrisy that existed in that one scene, I was just like, that's really fucking fantastic, and it makes, like, epitomizes that these guys don't give a shit about any moralities, even in,
yes.
You know, it's...
They've completely dehumanized whatever was human about the Bible.
Yes, it is a commodity, yeah.
Which is so, I mean, neither of us are particularly religious, but you can imagine that anyone that was religious, and certainly involved in Christianity, you'd be all about why turn a Bible into a fat wad of cash?
It's that thing of they know the people that they are targeting, that they talk about, the low income and the kind of, for lack of a better term, like, the stupid people. They are the ones that are going to, because it's the Bible, and it is this sacred, this thing that's held up on a pedestal, that makes it more special and exclusive, and, they're easier for them to part with their money to do it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it is Bible salesmen, instead of, like, you know, insurance, or, you know, toaster ovens, or, like, whatever, you know.
Selling.
He meets another guy who is a door-to-door salesman that's a vacuum cleaner salesman.
Yeah,
it's like it's.
But it's common practice to sell ideas.
Yeah,
Coke sells happiness.
Yes,
you know, like that's why it does so well.
Yeah,
because it's managed to produce a product that is to many people quote happiness.
Yes, same as McDonald's,
and that's what they've decided. I mean, like you could when you watch the film and you get to the segments where there is kind of the head honchos delivering their. What is it?
The motivational biannually
speech,
whatever it is. The sales
meetings.
Yeah.
You get a real sense that they've kind of scientifically, psychologically plucked the Bible itself as this one thing that we can just cram down people's throats.
It's the idea behind the Bible versus the actual product that they are selling themselves.
Yeah, sell an idea that's potentially priceless to some people and give them some piece of shit product that you can capitalize on this huge margin.
Yes.
And the Bible does that.
Yeah. So, based on that, these are not fun people to hang out with.
Yeah.
For 90 minutes.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't want to hang out with these guys for 5 minutes, let alone 90.
But where I think the film is commendable is in what it did for documentary filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why I understand it is in the collection, and it's in the National Film Registry, and it's all these things, and it is lauded as a documentary. And that is because it is the first kind of real non-fiction film. Like, every other documentary kind of prior to this, like, this was 1968. Just using ones we've had from the collection as an example, like Nanook of the North from the 20s.
Yeah.
That was an informative thing. Like, it has a purpose, and it's there to educate. Whereas this is fly-on-the-wall non-fiction versus educational. And it's kind of that's the differing and kind of advancement of that genre.
What do you feel about the ways of telling human stories? Because in Nanook of the North, it's a human story.
Yes.
But you're told fact after fact.
Yes.
So it's always a kind of...
They are structuring a narrative for you as well by doing that in that way, I think.
There might be some bias because you've got a different culture taking stock of another culture.
Whereas I think these more non-fiction documentaries like Salesman and like Grey Gardens, which we'll get to, I think what makes them interesting is there is no setup, there is no framework, and it's just presenting you these people and take from it what you will,
mm-hmm.
I guess. And that I think is a super interesting idea for documentary. And it's one that's kind of, you know, been done in the past. Like, you know, it's kind of advanced that genre, I meant to say. Like, it's something unique, yeah. And yeah.
That's right.
It's a progression of the art form, which I think is commendable.
To me, that's the perfect way to tell a human story.
Yeah.
So often you find that by placing forcing a story arc into a documentary, you're changing the subject matter.
Yeah.
Maybe too much.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Whereas this, they just filmed for a month, I think it was, and then got back to the editing room and were just like, let's try and cobble this together in whatever we've got.
Because no one has any goal other than to sell Bibles.
No, it's just it is literally just presenting you a week in the life of a salesman.
Yeah.
And like the ups and downs. Oh, it's 4 days, I think. And so it's like the ups and downs, and it's like what they actually go through and what that life entails. And take from it as an audience what you will. We're not going to slap on any prejudice. We're not going to slap on any judgment. We're just going to present it as it is presented to us, which I think is just pure documentary filmmaking.
Where's this kind of documentary filmmaking gone now? I mean, like, if Salesman was the beginning of... Is there a term for this kind of documentary?
No, the term I saw was non-fiction film.
Let's say, like, fly on the wall documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
Is where... Maybe some examples of... Yeah, let's take it through to current day documentary
film. I was trying to think of, like, some good examples, and I... Honestly,
it's changed somewhat.
Dark Days, possibly, which is a film about the homeless people living in the New York subway system,
mm-hmm.
like the underground tunnels there. That's kind of similar to that, where it just presents you this. And there is no, you know, obviously there is some judgment and message because it's talking about a gritty subject matter, but, you know, they focus on a few key homeless people and they tell their a week in the life of kind of thing. So that's kind of similar.
And if you take all of the mockumentaries that started to crop up in the kind of...
Yeah,
70s and
I mean,
80s,
the Christopher
right?
Guest films are very, I think, highly influenced
yeah.
by this.
Yeah, like Spinal Tap seems like it's just like, let's take that idea
yeah.
and apply it to rock
I
stars.
Think that was also kind of... Spinal Tap in particular is kind of also fucking with the whole format of the concert documentary and the tour documentary.
Oh, there's
like,
a lot more going on there.
Yeah, like Gimme Shelter or Cocksucking Blues, like all those Rolling Stone films that came out. Sure. Like, it's kind of... Yeah, whereas...
Gimme Shelter is another good example, because that's...
Well, that's also the Maisel Brothers, these guys as well.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Mm, they made that in between... So they made Salesman first, then Gimme Shelter, then Grey Gardens. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But, I mean, I don't... I spent all day actually trying to fucking think of some good examples of this kind of non-fiction or like fly on the wall documentary. And I, or like the one, it's Grey Gardens to me just jumped out, like that's forever in my mind as the prime example of that type of filmmaking. And I don't know if there are any other modern documentaries that are kind of similar to that or like in that same vein.
No one's taking that torch and running with it.
Yeah, well, I think that might shift now given the new media landscapes, but I think it's mainly because it's a very hard thing to sell. Like, hey, go see a documentary that is about nothing really in particular. Oh, actually...
Well, they really, are yeah. discussing themes.
Yeah, but...
You know, various things, but they're kind of... I would say that these... kinds of documentaries may be inaccessible to larger audiences.
Yeah, like I went and saw one recently. I went and saw this wonderful documentary called Sherpa, which at its outset was going to be about the aftermath of like the climbing year previous. There was a fight that broke out between European climbers and the native Sherpas, and it was like a fucking brawl on base camp of Everest. And so it was like next year climbing season, we want to kind of appease that. And so it was following this one Sherpa and his story that first week leading up to the first expeditions. But unfortunately, there was a huge ice slide and like the biggest fatalities ever on Everest. So the documentary kind of halfway shifts to like this bigger thing.
This other story.
Like the intention of that documentary was to be like, we're going to present the life of a Sherpa and what that means to them, and, like, you know, how they overcome this conflict and blah, 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 blah. But, yeah, that pivoted.
What about that, like, there's these documentaries that we...
Oh, like the Up series as well? That's a good example of that, actually, sorry.
Yeah.
I totally interrupted what you were getting.
No, it's fine.
The 7-Up series, where it's the British filmmaker, I'm fucking blanking on his name, which is not good. It's not Mike Lee, but it's someone like that. Where they, he made a film called 7-Up, and then 14-Up, then 21-Up. He keeps going every 7 years, and where these certain people are at their lives.
Mm.
And it's like a just...
I've watched some of that. That's very good.
Mm.
I'm more interested in... Most documentaries that I see nowadays are the kind of Michael Moore style ones, where you have a narrator that's there. Not you know, like, not those on-screen narrators.
No, the voiceover narration.
The cameraman, or there's an actual person like Michael Moore, who's kind of going to a place and telling a story.
Yeah.
Asking questions. Not so much the fly-on-the-wall stuff, but there's a little bit more of a presence of the questioner there.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about... What's the film that got the best documentary? It had a sequel recently.
Oh, Act of Killing? The Look of Silence?
Yeah, I see a lot of documentaries that are kind of like that now, where it's
interviews,
fly-on-the-wall stuff, but also has that questioner's voice kind of pushing through as well.
There's no narration in Act of Killing or Look of Silence.
Wasn't there?
No, it's all interviews. All interviews and news pieces. But it has I think you're associating it with the Michael Moore aspect because it is very heavily politically charged.
Maybe that's what I'm doing.
But I think you're right. There is, like, I think it was ever since Roger and Me, Michael Moore's first film in 1988, and then obviously Bowling for Columbine in 2002, I want to say. Like, when those films came out, there's a very clear, and they did so fucking well that it's kind of shifted documentary into that vein.
That mode, where there's, like, Super Size Me was a byproduct of
See it in things like Capturing the Friedmans, or, like, even on HBO, like, with The Jinx. Like, that had a very... where the filmmaker was almost more of a character than the subject was, and that's kind of... I think because... I think documentary can be presented in so many different ways that whatever is selling at the moment is, like, the easiest way to get your message out there.
They really do ebb and flow. Someone makes a new kind of documentary and everyone jumps all over it.
Yeah, which is, again, back to that point I was making, why I don't think we see this type of documentary anymore, because it is so fucking hard to market and it's so hard to get out to a specific audience. Or a mainstream audience, that it's something that only really existed in the 60s and the 70s, back when there really was the last great independent cinema boom.
Mm.
So that's... yeah.
Wilbur.
I think your bed's made, buddy.
Stop digging into your pillows.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything... salesman, you want to say?
Well, I mean, there wasn't much in the way of trivia for this film, so I found a few kind of facts about the history of the production I could go through and see if that... yeah.
Alright.
So the Menzel brothers decided that they wanted to make the first non-fiction feature film, which turned out to be Salesman, after they learned that Truman Capote had made the claim that his newly released book, In Cold Blood, was a non-fiction novel. So kind of prompted off of that idea that Capote... creative, where it's like he's going to tell a story but in a non-fiction form, is where they got the idea to do this. And
that's really just a way of saying that it's going to be absent of any structure.
Yes.
You're going to be drip-fed moments.
Yeah.
And then you connect those moments.
And whatever...
the editor's going to connect the moments, really. Yeah. But you're going to start to, with those moments connected, create your own sort of story list.
Yeah, it's like, we're just going to present you facts and you will construct a narrative based on how they affect you, I think. Which is, it's super interesting.
It's getting into the minds. It allows you to step into the minds.
It's character study at its core. That's all it is. And it's really interesting.
Because if there's no story structure, then you're not asking questions of...
You're not asking narrative questions, you're asking, I think... human questions, like, or, you know, character questions, I guess.
Right. I don't know how to form, like, how to, like, I'm forming this thought, this these thoughts, but there's, if you're just watching them from moment to moment, it's maybe it's given you the opportunity to just ponder their point of view rather than waiting for stuff to happen.
Yeah.
So if you're, it gives it a more expansive feeling. Do you know what I mean? Like, if it's just a day in the life and there's no story structure, there's no beginning and end, it gives you, it kind of, you can imagine
this broader scope that is what's happening either side of this.
You can, yeah, you can imagine them before the film and you can imagine them after the film.
Which I think they, in particular the salesman, like they pepper those little moments in where Paul is sort of saying, like, you know, he's getting homesick, he feels like he hasn't been home in 4 weeks, and it's like this continual thing. And contrasting that as well with, like, in the next scene, you have seen, there's like a, one scene where it's like a, it holds for a minute on him just sitting there staring into space. And it just, like, presents you that. It's like, whatever you want to think that he's thinking about or what he's being introspective about, like, that's on you. Like,
that's, we're not that's gonna, some cool shit right there.
Yeah, so that's why I think this is a kind of an important documentary, because it is doing something new and different. Yeah, so I guess, like, the only other kind of fact-based stuff I had here was that, it was a low-budget production, that the Maisels actually are self-funded. It costed approximately $100,000. The Maisels paid each salesman $100, along with the expenses that, you know, went along with the trip. During production, the crew consisted of Albert Maisels shooting and lighting, and David Maisels doing sound. Albert never prompted anyone from the film, except for when he asked Paul to describe his fellow salesman, which is that scene in the car where he's like, you got the rabbit, you got the bull, you got the blah, blah, blah. Like, and he's doing his breakdown of who everyone is and how he thinks they are a salesman and what their roles are within the company. And
Because the bottom line is, if, like, there's some parts of the story, there's some connections you need explained.
Yeah, I mean, like we said, this is a character study, and if we don't even know the base characters, it's going to be real. Like, up until that point, we didn't even really know anyone's name, and this was like 40 minutes in.
But how true to the fly on the wall documentary can you get?
Yeah,
you know, like, I'd like to see versions of
where it's just absolutely no, like, and it's just,
I'm not
going
to ask any fucking questions. I'm literally a fly on the wall. As opposed to the versions where it's like, I'm going to have to ask these questions and these questions, at bare minimum. Hopefully I get them.
Or at least spur on conversation, or, like, you know, do something in that regard.
Because Grey Gardens, there was obviously questions being asked.
Yeah, I think it was that was more conversational based, I think.
Well,
because those characters were, those women are just fucking batshit crazy.
Yeah, it was more opportunistic questions as opposed to, I've got these pre-written questions that I need to know.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So in determining what the Maisel brothers were actually going to film, they actually looked at the salesman schedule and kind of broke down the production through that and figured they would start with them and then film the progression from, I think it's Chicago or Boston to Florida, or, like, you know, the moving of location. And throughout the production, the Maisel brothers sent footage to Charlotte Zerwin, who viewed the footage and provided feedback. And when post-production began, David Maisels and Zerwin tried to structure a story about the four salesmen, but found that they didn't actually have enough material or interesting information, so they instead structured the story all around Paul.
It felt strange because I had the sensation that we were following four.
Yeah.
But we were only following one.
Yeah.
And they set it up as four.
Yeah, but then they kind of realised, like, he's the strongest, and yeah.
And to be quite frank, it's better with one.
Yeah. The Maisel brothers themselves had actually been door-to-door salesmen in the past, selling everything from cosmetics to encyclopedias. And when they were filming, it actually became part of the pitch for the salesmen when they would go door-to-door. And they would say, like, you know, don't mind the camera crew here, this is a... they would describe it as a part of a human interest story.
Mm.
And that's how that kind of, I'm sure, helped
kind of get them through the door.
Yeah.
Because
so,
people like to be famous.
Exactly. I think they're going to be on the TV.
People.
Yeah.
So brutal.
Yeah. But yeah, that was the kind of little bit of trivia and all, like, backstory info I kind of had on salesmen there. But
well, it's a really, it's super fucking well made, and it's completely infuriating to watch.
Yeah.
But there is a fascination and entertainment that comes from watching certain lower class people battle the wits of pretty good salesmen.
Yeah.
Of people that are willing to have to people that are willing to provide an opportunity for a poor person to make a stupid purchase.
Mm. And I think it's, while it's not exactly, you know, the most fun film to watch, I do think it is an important one, and one that's worth seeing, especially if you're a fan of documentaries, to kind of see this kind of progression of, like, beginnings of the art form, and, like, you know, shifting it away, and, like, how the Maisel brothers took one specific form and kind of developed it and made it into something unique and new.
Yeah.
So, documentaries don't solely have to be educational. They can be stories about people. Like, it doesn't have to be,
you know. Even fucking boring salesmen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's what I think I like the most about it. Mm. Is that it's the most fucking mundane job. And then two brothers were willing to be like, I could fucking make a movie about that.
Yeah. There's got to be something there. Yeah. And it's fucking,
and there is.
To the point that it is in the National Film Registry in the Library of Congress. Like, it is. Yeah. It had lasting impact. So, but I guess, unless you've got anything else to say, it's probably time to shift on over to Grey Gardens.
Yeah, I have to have a wee, though, so I'll just do that first. Excuse me.
Seen Grey Gardens before?
This is my first watch. Yeah. We just finished watching it.
Yeah, this was a film I discovered probably in like 2002, maybe, and over the years I've kind of watched multiple times because I am fucking fascinated by this film, and I find it very conflicting in terms of like what it is.
Yeah, it's quite challenging.
Yeah.
Quite fascinating duo.
Yeah.
Do you want to do a synopsis?
Yeah, it's similar to Salesman in that it is a fly-on-the-wall kind of, or non-fiction narrative film about Big Edie and Little Edie, the Beals, who are the aunt and cousin of Jacqueline Kennedy. So they're part of the Bouvier family line. And they live in a house in the Hamptons that is dilapidated and overgrown and festering and disgusting. And the history behind it is the Maisels were actually doing a documentary about, I think it was Jackie Kennedy's mother or sister. They were doing a kind of Kennedy film, but in researching and in the initial interview process, they discovered the Beals and were like, oh, fuck that other documentary. This is way more interesting.
Yes.
And shifted and started following these ladies. And it's sort of just, there's no narrative, again, similar to Salesman. It is just presenting you the life of these two, I was going to say crazy women, but I think that's unfair and I shouldn't jump to that.
No.
But it's these two eccentric.
They're certainly eccentric.
But yeah, and they're kind of what goes into their life and how they live it at the moment. Having come from this, like, aristocratic, rich money of old New York to living in a house that has fucking raccoons eating their walls and all of this
and
shit.
And God knows how many cats.
Yeah.
And, yeah, too odd.
That was in such squalor that the police tried to get them to, they had to vacate, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
So,
So
let's go into, I suppose we could just, in this case, this is the difference that I find between Salesman and Grey Gardens, is with Salesman, I wanted to talk about the film, like the technical aspects of the film.
Yeah.
With Grey Gardens, I feel more compelled to talk about the ladies.
Yes.
And I think that's because
There is
so much to the ladies.
Yeah, that is the film. There is no journey. There's no real narrative. It is just presenting you these two women.
Yeah.
And take from it what you will, I guess. And that's the story. It's just like, hey, look at this.
I mean, it's kind of like a comedy. I mean, at first I was treating it like a comedy, which
is where I have, like, conflicts with film. Like, I initially, like, it's this film is very lauded in documentary world, and, like, this is, like, considered to be, like, the pinnacle of the fly on the wall documentary and, like, what the Maisels were doing in terms of style and structure. But viewed, like, I used to love it, and now as I've gotten older, I watch it and it walks that very delicate line between are you being exploitive? Like, what is your purpose behind doing this? And
is it a study piece on sadness, or is it a freak show?
Yes, which is, like, the problem. And I think that's, you know,
for an immature mind, you would laugh at it.
I never laughed at it, really. I found it fascinating.
But excuse me, because you were laughing at it from time to time.
Now, yes. But I'm saying, but you said younger mind. Like, when I was younger, I never laughed. I was always fascinated by it. And I think that's what makes this film so interesting, is because these two women are infinitely fascinating. Yeah. Like, I am just... You become transfixed by who they are and what they are and where... Like, their world is so... batshit crazy that you just can't help but watch.
It's also abrasive.
Yeah.
At the same time, because, I mean, both of them, due to their personalities, tend to yell, tend to screech.
Yeah.
And tend to waffle on. And so it becomes a white noise of, like, irritant.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I got transfixed upon their constant kind of falling back into past memories, and talking about the good old days kind of stuff, and it was fascinating to watch two people. I mean, it's really the daughter that was really pining after the old days, or really like what could have been. And this, I mean, we're really talking about the complexity of a relationship, because you've got an older mother that relies heavily on the daughter but wouldn't ever tell her that.
No.
And has kind of almost Stockholm syndromed her.
Yeah. It 100% is that.
Yeah.
She can't leave, and she won't leave until her mother is dead. I mean,
through constant beratement.
Yeah.
She's crippled her daughter into thinking she's not good enough for anybody except her mother,
which is I find super interesting as well. And the Maisels are really smart in this, that they only bring it up about halfway through the film of like, oh, she has two brothers, like where are they in this whole scenario that they've allowed this to happen to their family? Like, it's and but it's like, no, but we're not presenting that story, so we're not gonna... That's not the... We're not, you know, doing a traditional documentary form, so we're not going to...
Exactly.
Discuss them.
That's a side note.
Yeah.
That's a side note.
But it just raises more questions in you as a viewer as to what... And makes this even more fascinating to watch.
It feels kind of incomplete when you know that there is... Like, I want to know, how did they come to be like this?
Yes. Yeah.
But what was never the thing that really
pushed them? Yeah.
That's right. I mean, you get inclinations that it's something to do with the break, like with the death of the father.
Well, no, he left, and
he tried
to get like a dodgy... He got a divorce in Mexico that they didn't think was viewed legitimate. Like, they didn't recognize it, and
of course
he remarried, and then yeah. So he, like, the father abandoned and stuff, and then the mother kind of had a few suitors that Little Edie didn't approve of throughout the years, and it's...
Yeah.
But then it's super interesting that in turn, any suitor that Little Edie had, Big Edie didn't approve... Oh, it's just a fucking, like... It's Ouroboros. It's like a snake eating its own tail. It's just fucking this family. It's nuts.
Yeah, there's so much about them that I want to kind of get into, so...
Yet we are presented so little in the film that's what I think is genius about it.
It's the mystery.
Yes. And you want to know who these people are and what they are, and we only really get four or five conversations that are informative.
I mean, like, but there's more than conversation too, because if you look at what young Edie is wearing,
yes,
she's kind of, although it's the 70s, 60s, she's kind of stuck in the decades previous.
Yeah.
Where she was a younger woman.
It's Arrested Development. She's stuck in a stage of, you know, she...
Yeah, like some previous development.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of her clothes suggest that she is kind of wishing that her body was not aging, and she's just never been able to kind of reconcile what's happening to her now with what was happening to her previously.
Yeah.
And then she starts to blame her mother.
Yeah, for chasing the men away, and, you know, the fact that she has to stay here to look after her.
Yeah.
That's why she isn't in New York and doesn't have a husband and all this. It's...
Yeah, was I making a point? I can't remember.
It's all of these elements that this is truly a 90-minute or, you know, 100-minute character piece.
Mm-hmm.
And there is just, like, that thing we were saying with Salesman, it is just take whatever you can, I guess. Yeah. Like, it like will affect everyone, I think, totally different, and you'll kind of attach meaning to stuff that you don't...
Depending on your own, your own experiences.
Exactly.
I mean, we were watching and we were, like, associating personality traits with people we knew.
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
Starting to apply our own experiences with what we were seeing. And...
Yeah, you can't help but do that because there is no narrative to it, so you as a viewer try to attach one to it. And that's what I think sustains you as a viewer.
I think my experience with... I mean, the first 15 minutes being... I was kind of attacking it as a freak show.
Yeah.
And then you start to learn about them and appreciate them, and your understanding of them deepens.
That, I think, is the problem. Like I said, the film walks a very delicate line. Like, it...
But I was teetering from one to the other.
Yes, that's my problem as well. But I don't think... I think the Maisels didn't approach it with malicious intent. And that's what I think is the important...
No, but that's my brain doing...
Yes.
That's producing malice from time to time.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating because, I mean, everybody in... I mean, fucking Long Island was like, get these people the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
And clean up that goddamn shithole.
Yeah. But that makes for interesting individuals. And I think that's why the Maisels made this film and, you know... spent so much time there shooting them was because I don't think they were disgusted by them or were, like, trying to mock them. I think they were just genuinely intrigued at, like, who these two women are and how they came to be.
You're right.
The real
amazing fact about the filmmakers on this part is that they were willing to give them 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Because initially you're drawn away by these people. The first images you see is a disgusting house, flies everywhere, shit everywhere.
And newspaper cuttings saying that, you know, the
town hates them. Seeing that not on a screen, but in person.
Yeah.
I mean, like, imagine if the fucking DVD, the special features, came with a scratch and sniff.
Yeah, it would not be good.
You know, like, that alone would turn you away from that house.
Yeah.
So the amazing part about this to me is that the two brothers were able to just fucking stick with it for 5 minutes.
And find humanity within
it. To break through the freak show.
Yeah.
Because, there's fucking heaps here.
Yeah, and that's why I love this movie. It is rough to watch, but I think it's super intriguing.
It's bittersweet.
Yeah.
There's, you know, the poor mum, I mean, they're all poor. Like, they're all kind of broken and poor.
Yeah.
But you just feel sorry for them in the end.
Yeah.
And you but you also kind of love them.
Yeah.
To some, like, you want them, you wish that they had it better.
Yeah.
You wish that they had, that there's an air of, it's not just their fault. Society's let them down too.
Yeah.
So you kind of go like, yes, you're responsible for a large part of your lot, but then not the whole thing. And so you've been dealt some shitty hands.
But, yeah, and it's just how they dealt with it, I guess, and it's, yeah.
It's a great film.
It really is. Like,
I wasn't too turned on by Salesman, but I really appreciated Grey Gardens.
Yeah, but like I said, it's a rough watch at times, and it does, the pacing is real slow, and I think that is because of the lack of narrative, and it is just... Here's a scene of them talking, followed by another scene of them talking, and another... Like, there is no structure or narrative, which makes it feel like it's dragging a little bit.
But
yeah, I think at the hour mark, I decided to check the time signature of the film.
Yeah,
said it was kind of it was like it was leaking on, dripping on.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, yeah, there is some pacing issues I get, but then that's the product of a fly on the wall documentary.
Exactly, and that's why I think, like, if I wanted to show someone a perfect example of that style of documentary filmmaking, it would be this. I think it's just, not least of which it has literal flies covering all of the walls in every room. It's disgusting. It's, yeah. I enjoy this film.
It's a great film.
Yeah. I don't know, was there anything else you wanted to...
I don't know. There's heaps of moments that I'd like to... There's heaps of moments that I enjoyed. I think it's just... I think we've touched on everything.
Yeah, it's the problem of... Because the film is nothing but moments, I think it's... Like, you know, we could say, like, oh, the moment where Edie is dancing, doing her soft shoe routine with a little American flag.
Yeah.
But you're just like, what... You know,
it's
you
fine.
Know?
Just what you, everybody's either watched the film or will probably watch it based on our recommendations.
Yeah, there's nothing... Like, we will gain nothing from us saying, like, oh, this moment and this moment. Because it is just... You can't exactly even articulate what the fuck you're seeing a lot of the time.
Yeah. But also, actually, there is one thing. She wasn't bald. She had white hair.
Yeah, white hair, yeah.
Young Edie.
Yeah.
So in some instances you can see that the sun shined through and it looked like she was bald.
Mm.
So...
And she definitely has... white or clear eyebrows as well, like,
yeah,
this, or...
I was always wondering, there's just one thing that kind of I wanted, this is another mystery that the film leaves you with, is that you want to know why she cares so much about the top of her head. Is it because she's got white hair and she's ashamed that she's got white hair now,
or she doesn't want to get sunburnt, or what?
Well,
the...
yeah, I mean, like, because yeah, is she ashamed that she can't, like, that she's now growing old and she wants to hide her signs of aging, or is she actually bald?
Yeah,
I don't think she was bald. I saw some.
Yeah,
white,
there was like that
hair.
Little. You get a little bit of a widow's peak popping out at one point. Yeah,
she never. So she never gave you the opportunity to get deep into her mind to that point where she will actually like spill out the beans about her severe, what do you call it, image problems?
Yeah. And crippling anxieties and things, yeah.
But it was stuff like that. It was just like no one's created that. She's just that's a product of her personality that she hides her hair.
Yeah, it's,
and it speaks so much about her personality. It's just one thing that you can just look at. No one's explaining it. You just think about it the whole film.
Given all these elements, do you reckon Grey Gardens could be like the greatest mystery film ever? Like, we're given nothing yet. You're so intrigued.
Yeah, that's true. It's up there, that's for sure. Yeah. I'm not going to say it's the best.
No. I guess on that note, unless you've got anything else, I'm happy to jump onto trivia and kind of begin to wrap it up, I guess.
Yeah, okay. Just go on
trivia. So in 2010, the film was also inducted into the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress. So Maisels have both of those in there, which is just, I feel. The film that's...
I agree.
I'd already kind of mentioned this, that the filming was more of an accident, and they were actually filming about... it was Lee Radziwill, who was Jackie Kennedy's sister. And then they kind of met the Beals and shifted onto that.
Harvey. Sorry.
No.
Oh, the Mogwai singing.
Grunting.
What is wrong with the voice?
Go on.
This one I just thought was kind of... Ooh. So, Little Edie claimed that the house was haunted by the ghost of a sea captain who used to climb a ladder into her room for midnight trysts. She also claimed that the house was haunted by ghosts of a woman and her daughter, who were the original residents of the house. However, the first residents of the house were Mrs. F. Stanhope Phillips and the daughter of the first editor of the Detroit Free Press, and she actually had no kids, so that was...
That's plain wrong.
Plain wrong.
You get inclinations of superstition, because there's all this talk about the star signs and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, fuck, she yeah.
The House Grey Gardens was sold by Little Edie in 1979 to Benjamin C. Bradley, former editor of the Washington Post, and Sally Quinn. The pair completely restored the house. The sales agreement actually forbid them from raising the house and demolishing it. But the Bradleys only stay there in 1 month of the year, in August, during the kind of summer season. During the rest of the year, the home is occupied by Francis Haywood, who I'm guessing is the groundskeeper or the, you know, tenant or whatever. Yeah.
So, yes, this is something that I'm intrigued by.
Yeah.
So what happened to
Big Edie? Died. Weirdly, I'm not able to find the information, but I think she died a year, like in 1977 or 78, like a year or two after this documentary was made.
Okay.
She ended up dying, and then Little Lady kind of sold the house, and I think she's still alive. She moved to New York, like she kind of always planned to.
She went to
things,
the big city.
But I don't know if anything, like,
can we look up some shit?
Yeah, you can find, there's links to, like, interviews with her as recent as 2009, discussing everything that's, like, you know, the Grey Gardens and all that.
Oh, fucking hey.
Yeah.
Let's put that up on
I'll post links. Yeah, I think it was 2009, because in 2009 there was a TV movie that was made, kind of using this documentary as a source, and it starred Drew Barrymore and Jessica Lange, and kind of telling their real story. So I think when that came out, and there was a lot of, you know, kind of reinvigoration for the original and things, and so Little Edie did a bunch of press. So yeah, I'll post a link to a couple of the articles.
Yeah, so I want to know what happened to this crazy bitch.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the thing. She was never going to be destitute, because they were old money and things, and they, you know, obviously the sale of that house would have been.
No, I know, but I'm intrigued as to, like, as I say, the, like, beyond the film, does she get past her crippled spirit?
Did she end up remarrying?
I mean, what happens when the Stockholm syndrome vanishes because the person that's administering Stockholm syndrome dies?
Yeah,
like, does the person overcome that or whatever? Also, oh yeah, go on, fuck it.
No,
I was going to say, speaking of alternative links and recent commemorations of the film, are you going to bring up Bill Hader?
Oh yeah, I was going to bring that up towards the end, but
oh, we'll just do your trivia then.
Oh yeah, no, the only other piece I had was kind of similar to the 2009 TV movie, the Drew Barrymore and Jessica Lange, was that there was actually a Broadway musical version of Grey Gardens.
Oh, that's perfect.
That ran for 308 performances, starting in November 2nd, 2006, and was nominated for Best Musical, Book, and Score at the 2007 Tony Awards.
Shit.
So it was actually a well-received musical version of this, which I had no idea existed before today, and kind of want to look up.
Yeah, I want to look that shit up. Yeah. That'd be crazy, man.
Mm. But, yeah.
How are you going to do a good dance show when the main character can't dance for shit?
That makes it all the better.
I suppose you just be mesmerized and mysterious.
You have a stage
by
full of the Langs.
Yeah, pretty much.
The Lane Dennis.
But the other thing that Tom was just mentioning as well is if you're at all interested, there are a couple of absolutely wonderful parodies of both of these documentaries. There's the fucking fantastic show from IFC called Documentary Now, created by Fred Armisen, Bill Hader, and Seth Meyers. It's currently available on Netflix if anyone's got it. The first episode of that series is them doing their version of Grey Gardens. Like, each episode is a kind of piss take or a rip-off of a famous documentary. And like, I think majority of the episodes are Criterion films as well. Like, they're very films, like, you know, film savvy.
Artsy,
so. Yes.
If you want.
So their version of Grey Gardens, which is called Sandy Passages, is very, very worthwhile. And also, if you have Netflix as well, I would recommend looking at the fourth episode of With Bob and David, the kind of new season of Mr. Show that Bob and Kirk and David Cross did. At the end of the fourth episode, they do a fucking fantastic parody of Salesman. It's shot on film, it's shot in black and white, and it's just like one simple based joke at the premise of it, and it's just presented exactly the same way in style of Salesman, and it's really fucking funny.
Sweet.
So if you've seen these docos and want to get a little bit of levity out of them, check out those two things if you've got Netflix. But
we'll post info about that.
Yeah, yeah. But we'll move on to the actual Criterion editions of the films themselves. Both of them are still in print. Salesman is available as a one-disc DVD. It's also available on iTunes and Hulu. But the physical copy comes with an audio commentary by Albert Maisel and Charlotte Zerwin, a 1968 Jack Kroll television interview with David and Albert Maisel, The Rabbit on NPR's Weekend Edition from 2000, actually, behind-the-scenes photographs, theatrical trailer, and usual booklet and essays, while Grey Gardens, on the other hand, also still in print as a one-disc DVD, is also available as a one-disc Blu-ray. And it comes with The Beals of Grey Gardens, the 2006 sequel film. When it was the anniversary in 2005, the 25-year anniversary of Grey Gardens, or 35, or my mouth sucks, the Maisels handed over...
Phrasing.
Yeah. They, the Maisels handed over all the footage they had to Criterion, and managed to cobble together and construct a second film using all of the kind of other stuff. Yeah, so The Beals of Grey Gardens, that's only available on the Blu-ray edition. But both editions come with an audio commentary featuring Maisels.
That's got to be the best special feature I've come across.
It kind of comes in this two-disc kind of box set thingy, yeah.
Like an original film based off the original films.
Yeah, using original negative pieces and actually getting the Maisels to help construct it and put it together.
Like 35 years old or whatever.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
That's Criterion.
Yeah.
So audio commentary featuring the Maisels and co-directors Ellen Hoedver and Muffy Meyer, along with associate producer Susan Fromke. Introduction to The Beals of Grey Gardens by the Maisel brothers. Audio excerpts from a 1976 interview with Little Edie Beale, conducted by Catherine G. Graham. Interview with fashion designers Todd Oldham and John Barrett on the continuing influence of Grey Gardens in the fashion world, as well as behind-the-scenes photographs, trailers, booklets, essays, all that jazz.
That fashion stuff, man. That would be fascinating. Have you watched that?
No, I actually haven't, so we got the disc, we can give it a look-see, I guess. Yeah. But I guess that'll... Unless you got anything else that'll, I guess, wrap us up for this week's episode.
Nah.
Yeah. We're going to kind of start mixing things up a little bit, and we're going to kind of scale back from being a weekly podcast, just with, you know, both our work schedules and study schedules kind of intensifying as of late. So we're now going to be scaling back to a fortnightly show. So if there's no new episode next week, don't stress. It will be coming out the week after. We just kind of need to... Other things that have to kind of take priority, but
yeah, we're sorry that we've been a little bit, just pressed.
Yeah,
to push out content weekly.
Yeah, we still appreciate everyone listening and downloading enjoying the show. So don't fret. It will still be same old show as usual, just once a fortnight now as opposed to once a week. So hopefully, you still enjoy and listen along.
Yeah,
because we will be back in a fortnight's time with a massive endeavor. Actually, we've got another box set. We've got the Carr Theodore Dreyer box set, so we're going to be looking at Day of Wrath, Odette, and Gertrude from Carl Theodore Dreyer. He was the guy who made The Passion of Joan of Arc. That yes, kind of black and white surrealist.
Yes,
so
it's awesome.
I
don't remember that.
I know his Dracula film, Vampire. Like, I know that, and I know Passion of Joan of Arc. Other than that, I got nothing. So,
okay.
I'm wondering what we'll get out of these, but should be interesting. Yeah. Endorsement. But, if you have any comments or queries or anything, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @CriterionQuest. And like we said, I'll post links throughout the week of to either both the IFC Documentary Now show and the With Bob and David sketches, as well as all the kind of additional interviews and links about what Little Edie is up to nowadays.
Yeah, that's sweet.
Yeah.
I want to see all those things.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
And I'm Tom. See you next time.